What's up, everyone? This week on the pod, we're talking more hardcore, and this thing is packed. All killer, no filler. So what's up with that? Also, we're doing another contest. So when you hear the title of this podcast, you can shoot me an email, 185milessouth@gmail.com. Let me know when you heard it. If you heard of the 20-minute mark, the 45-minute mark, the 75-minute mark, et cetera, et cetera. And we'll enter you into a contest. The winner gets a package from me. So check that out. It is going to be fun. And also, subscribe to the podcast. That helps the most. And you can go to 185milessouth.com. It's got all the playlists for every episode. It's got all our links. Smash that Patreon button. You know what to do. And let's get on with the show.
Miles South, a hardcore punk rock podcast.
Vocal test karaoke.
All right, to start off the pod this week, this is a fun idea that I have been kicking around with Roger, and I wanted to do it, and it helps to have brilliant friends. They could lay this shit down. So, yeah, this is fun. This is us doing vocal test karaoke. It's Retaliate with Greg from Take Offense, busting that solo. And let's get it started. First dude up is Chris Ramos from Dead Heat. You got to go pre-order the new Dead Heat record. It's called World at War. You can get it at Triple B Records. And Chris, handle business, dude. Chris, handle the business. I love it. You want more? What? Oh, ask and you shall receive, friend. How about Jeremy D. Smith from Tuning? He's going to handle business right now, but you got to check out. There's a new Tuning record. It is coming out July 2nd on the mighty, mighty Indecision Records. It is called A Beacon in Impossible Seas. So handle business. Pre-orders go up early June. Start saving your money now. That record rips. But here's Jeremy. It's vocal test karaoke. What's up, everyone? We are going to have a whole segment where we dial in to Bedge's Baby, which is the 1.5 article. You got a bunch of people on here. First off, his co-author, it is Daniel Weitzman. Then we got Ben on the phone. You guys all know him. Also got Dan Sant and Anthony Pappalardo. But I wanted to shoot it off to Daniel Weitzman first. Dan, we all know Ben here on this pod, but can you give a little history on yourself?
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit older than most of you guys. I started a fanzine in 1980 when I was 13. I actually used my bar mitzvah money to start it, called Rag and Chains. And I had X and Fear and the Germs on the cover. And at some point, Al Flipside asked me to start writing for them, and I became a regular contributor to Flipside and went on to do a column in the LA Weekly called High School Confidential. And all of that was under the pseudonym Shredder. And me and the main editor at the LA Weekly, Craig Lee, who was, of course, in the bags, put together the LA section of the book Hardcore California, which came out, I think, maybe in 83. I was like 16 or something at the time. I got paid $100 for it, and they misspelled my name on the, and I went on to do rock journalism in all kinds of formations, but around the age of 25 or 26, I stopped writing about punk rock entirely and did not write another word about it for, I think, almost 20 years. And then one day I met Ben actually at the wake of a mutual friend. And we started talking and we hit it off and we went out to lunch and we started talking about punk and hardcore and everything. And he introduced this idea of a middle zone, which really resonated for me. Because remember, those were the years that I was actually covering when I was writing for Flipside. So we developed this idea. We pitched it to Please Kill Me, and the rest is history.
Now, did you get out of punk because you became a giant Chili Peppers fan?
No, at least not immediately. Okay. I got out of punk for reasons which I think we're going to explore in this podcast, because I wasn't the only one that got out of it. And I gravitated towards the Paisley Underground, Salvation Army, the Gun Club. You know, I think I wrote the first ever article about the Gun Club, and I must have seen them. I must have seen their first 20 shows, you know. Dream Syndicate. Those were the kinds of groups I was obsessing on at that time. But we'll get into why I think this huge contingent that was absolutely passionate about punk just turned on a dime and stopped being passionate about it. Because I think that's a big part of the story that Ben is trying to tell.
You know, with that segue, no one can argue. You're probably a better host than me. God damn, that was good. Ben, why don't you give us a summation of the article? I know that we've kind of beat people over the head with it on the pod for the last couple of months, but now is your time to shine. Tell us about 1.5.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the article is you can read it yourself on pleasekillme.com. And the actual name of the article is The Zone in Between, a Hidden Rock and Roll Genre. And so the basic premise is there's this thing called punk, which is roughly the heyday of which is roughly 1976 to 1978. The big bands would be Ramones, Clash, Sex Pistols. In LA, you have the Weirdos and a lot of the Danger House bands. And so you have a slow to medium fast drumming style. You have open strumming guitar style. You have more melodic singing, snotty style vocals. Lyrical themes would be like anti-authoritarian, occasionally poetic. And then you have a kind of a destructive, what Daniel likes to call a Dionysian vibe, sort of a nihilistic view of the world. And you have gender parity at the shows, you know, like about half and half male, female. Average age of the show goer would be like early to mid 20s. It's kind of an urban centric phenomenon. This is happening in major cities. You have the fashion associated would be with like spikes, leather, spiky hair. You have pogo dancing, and you know we think of the mask in LA, for example. And of course, there are big, kind of well known venues in other major cities. And then you have this thing that happens around I mean, the Consumers is 1977. They're kind of an outlier. This is a band from Arizona. But really on the west coast of North America, kind of simultaneously in Vancouver, San Francisco, and in Southern California, you have this shift right around 1978 where there's a bunch of bands that start playing faster and they have a tendency towards surf beats. They still have the open strumming with the guitars. They still have the singing. They still have the snotty style vocals. There's less of an emphasis on romantic themes. Still anti-authoritarian, still nihilistic. So they're shifting away from punk, but they still share commonalities with punk. And you have a fewer women, fewer female to male ratio, and a much younger suburban audience, you know, 13 to 17 year olds going to shows, a de-emphasis on like the spikes and the leather, the more shorter hairstyles. And then you have the advent of slamming and stage diving. And then we think of bands like Adolescence in Southern California, Zero Boys in the Midwest, Reagan Youth in New York, Teen Idols in Washington, D.C. And we have called that 1.5. And then finally, and that's like 78 to 82 roughly would be the heyday. I mean, you can play any kind of music in any era and still be that thing. So it's not like anything ever died, but that would be the heyday. And then that shifts into this thing called hardcore, which is this third bucket. And that would be fast to hyper fast style drum beats, the introduction of scissor beats, you know, the dicka dicka dicka, real choppy style, and emphasis on tempo changes. You know, we love the breakdowns and the mosh parts. And a kind of a tendency towards palm muting and ultra quick chord changes on the guitar, vocal style, more shouting, a push away from melody, a more serious vibe. And then as you still have anti-authoritarianism, you have a total absence of romantic themes for the most part. Poetry replaced by direct messages, you know, I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't fuck. It's like, there's no two ways about it. You know what this guy's talking about. Like it's plainly spelled out. Nazi punks, fuck off. And so what Daniel calls this the Apollonian vibe, you know, it's like the god Apollo. And it's like a tendency away from the destructive nihilism and of punk and of 1.5. And then an overwhelmingly male and young audience, also suburban, almost complete disappearance of spikes and leather, at least in the US. And then you start seeing more shaved heads. And then circle pits forming, at least in California, and continuing slam and stage diving across the country. And we think of bands like Circle One, Minor Threat, Agnostic Front, Negative Approach, you know, super aggressive music that would be like the tentpole hardcore bands. And there are a few bands that sort of like within their entire catalogs, you can see them shift from one thing to another, like Dead Kennedys. You see the shift when they get D.H. Pellegrino on drums around 81. You see the shift with the Bad Brains as each record they do is faster and faster. And then they start kind of becoming Rastafarians and sort of preaching a message that they have, which is a very hardcore thing, a hardcore mentality. And then there's a few other bands that you see that shift from one bucket to the other. I like the term bucket. I got that from you, Zach. That's a basic premise of it. And
Ben, if I could just interrupt, I just want to extrapolate a little more on the Dionysian versus Apollonian theme, because I think it'll help explain to people that sort of see those things of a piece. It gives a kind of a lens to see things a little differently. You know, Dionysus is about chaos, destruction, sex, wild nature, you know, kids of the black hole. Right. And Apollo is, first of all, Apollo is a muscle man, but he's not just about masculine strength. He's about being socially constructive, you know. And I was thinking a song like Rise Above could never have happened inside 1.5. Like, try and think of the Germs singing Rise Above. They never would have that message, or even the Adolescents. Because it's a socially constructive message. It's saying we can actually build something.
Yeah, and Black Flag would be another example of a band that shifts from, you know, they start in 77 as Panic. They make their first record in 78. It doesn't come out till 79. And it's very much in that 1.5 mindset. And then they shift further and further away from that until they become really become a tentpole hardcore band with, you know, Rollins as their singer, at least by 81.
I think that you guys have done a fantastic job of defining basically the birth of hardcore and maybe what separates hardcore from punk. What I think is a little muddier is defining why 1.5 is different than like first wave punk. Because other styles of music, like, you know, a heavy metal or something, as time goes on, the bands just get a little bit more extreme, but there's no real reason to like give it a different category. Can you maybe dig into a little more what breaks out 1.5 from just being like a slight evolution of punk, and it needs to be something defined by itself?
Do you want to go? Because
yeah, let me go. Let me go on this, and then you'll have the facts. But I'm just going to bring the personal experience, which is, you know, punk in LA, circa The Mask, was honestly like 60 to 100 people strong in terms of the people that were actually shaping the culture. You know, I mean, I saw part of it because my sister dated a guy that knew the Plugs. You know, so that's how kind of how I got introduced to it. You know, when 1.5 happened, when GI came out and all the people that were my age, like those five kids in every junior high and high school that got into it, you were talking about a whole different demographic. I mean, we were really little kids, you know? So I think that's like the A number one split, that it's music suddenly, you know, often made by kids, but definitely playing to an audience packed with kids. That's my the main seismic shift that I remember.
May I interject real quick?
Well, yeah, that's Anthony Pappalardo.
That's
But real quick, Anthony.
Yeah, sure.
I still don't understand how, because wouldn't that just be like the next generation that is like taking up what was before them, and it's like now you're seeing that this punk thing actually has legs, and the next generation's taking over and doing the same thing. Maybe a little more extreme.
But you know, you got to understand too, it's The Mask versus The Cuckoo's Nest. There's a complete shift in the power center of this music out to the suburbs for the most part. And you have, you know, slamming, stage diving, and really for its time, totally extreme music. You have, you know, like, and there's an exodus. There are lots of people who were involved in that first generation of punk, you know, who were like, the Ramones are great. And then a band like The Adolescents comes along and it's like, I'm out. Like, I can't handle this.
Yeah. I just want to say one other thing too, which is that, you know, very often LA punk history is being talked about, Zach, the way that you're kind of framing it, which is there was The Mask and it was the most incredible thing in the world. And then there was just this kind of outgrowth of it. And one of the reasons I kind of signed on to work with Ben on this project is that is not how I experienced it. The thing that happened at The Mask was a miracle, and I'm not taking any of its power away. But what happened at the Fleetwood and the Cuckoo's Nest and the Starwood had a very different flavor. I mean, it was skateboarders. It was a whole different energy, and kind of shortchanging it as an afterthought bugs me.
Right. So you're saying that since it was like almost a complete turnover, that's what justifies it being a new thing and not
like the style of music is noticeably different though. I mean, the Sex Pistols and Reagan Youth don't sound very much like each other. In fact, the distance between those two is the same as the distance between a band like Reagan Youth and Agnostic Front. You know, I mean,
and it's the same as the distance between the Pistols and Cheap Trick, or more.
Well, that's going backwards, right?
Yeah.
The difference between rock and punk is the same as the difference between punk and 1.5 is the same as the difference between 1.5 and hardcore. And no one questions that punk is a genre unto itself, separate from rock. But this is pushing further in that extreme direction by the same increment, I would say. That's a good way of putting it.
Okay. So my question, and first of all, I want to preempt this by saying, I think it's a really compelling piece. It's a very well done piece. And if anyone hasn't read it, definitely dive into all of it and take the time to really digest it. But so as a, you know, I'm on the East Coast, right? Like a lot of this is West Coast centric. Obviously Reagan Youth isn't, that's fine. I think it'd be really valuable just to tap into why, and this is a question for either of you, why it was important to make this delineation and come up with this kind of like hidden genre and what the value of it is. Like why, I'm not playing devil's advocate at all. I'm not like a Larry King figure, but but you know, like if, like what would compel me to read this? Like what did y'all want to get out of this to bring to the cultural story? Because I think that's so important. And that's what's really interesting to me.
I think there's a way, like for decades now, I've been arguing with people about, you know, how to classify these bands like TSOL, the Germs LP, Fear, and also on the East Coast, the very early Bad Brains, Stimulators, the Mad, Reagan Youth, Kraut, in the Midwest, Zero Boys, you know, all these bands we're talking about. And like, people, there's absolutely no consensus among the band members themselves of all these bands on what they define themselves as. There's no consensus on the fans of these bands. You know, if you're coming at it from a punk perspective and you like these bands, you might say, oh, they're punk like me, or vice versa. And so I think it's like, here are these bands that all represent this generation between these two well-established genre terms that kind of like fall through the cracks as far as how they're defined. And they all have enough commonalities with each other that they really belong in the same boat. So it's sort of like, I guess the point of it is to draw attention to the greatness of these bands and also explain that evolution doesn't happen overnight. There was a middle stage between from punk turning into hardcore. And, you know, it's not like we've picked like three bands we thought kind of sounded similar and like decided to apply a genre name to three bands. There's a playlist that I created that's 189 songs big. So this is like a really significant number of bands that sort of all fall into this middle section that we're calling 1.5.
Is it fair to say that it's kind of like we like to group things into generations, whether it's like Gen X, Zoomer, whatever. Is it fair to say that 1.5 is literally what you're describing? You kind of have your foot in two generations. Like it's a between generation. Does that make sense?
Exactly. And in fact, after we started writing this, we found, I can't even remember, someone must have posted it on Facebook, that the, you know, baby boomers, it used to be anyone born immediately after World War II and before 1965 was considered a baby boomer. Well, that's a 20-year span. But then someone decided 1958 to 1964, the very youngest baby boomers were breaking that off and were naming that Generation Jones because they share similarities with each other and the way they were raised and the era they were raised. And it's funny because when I showed that piece to Daniel Weitzman, he said, 1958 to 64, these are the people, the kids who grew up and started 1.5 bands. I mean, Ian MacKaye was born in 1962. You can go on down the line. It's like, that's the age these people are. And it's so funny that, you know, you can look back at the era they were born and then someone broke them off into their own generation.
And you know, that actually leads to a key point, which is that 1.5 is connected to punk in a deeper way, in the same way that punk is really deeply connected to this long strain of bohemia that, you know, stretches back to the Beats and, you know, becomes rock and roll and rock music and LSD and all of that stuff. I mean, obviously punk is an outgrowth of that. And 1.5 in its own way is more deeply connected to that. When you listen to hardcore, You know, when you listen to Wasted Youth, you can feel that it's not connected to that, that you're dealing with kids that grew up, you know, in an environment that they had not personally experienced too much of the 60s at all.
I think that's fair. But again, I think that you guys have done a brilliant job of differentiating punk from hardcore. My confusion is, isn't like what you're calling 1.5, isn't that just hardcore punk?
Well, we figured out today that everything we're calling 1.5, you call hardcore punk. But the only thing, there are a few reasons why I think that calling that middle section hardcore punk sort of confuses the issue. And one is that hardcore, that third category, you know, the Circle One, Minor Threat, Agnostic Front, Negative Approach category, that actually is short for hardcore punk.
Right.
I think it got shortened out of it's just the way language works. You know, you don't say bebop jazz, you say bebop, and everyone knows you're talking about a form of jazz music, or things get shortened over time. And so, and it's also like, there's something that about that middle section that's not quite hardcore or not not quite punk. So to just call it hardcore punk kind of throws a wrench in it. And then the third reason is all three of these things, punk, 1.5, and hardcore, fall to me, they fall under this very large umbrella that is punk in general. This is the story of, this is one continuous story, right? So, you know, it's all punk in a matter of speaking. So, Zach,
yeah. imagine if we said going forward, we think punk should just be called proto 1.5 and hardcore should just be called post 1.5. You know, there's something that kind of weakens the sauce a little when you use another term. Like, I've never really loved the term jazz rock. You know, to me, jazz rock is neither. There's got to be a better word for it somewhere, you know? So that's kind of my answer, which is that it's fine to call it that. I mean, you know, a term is a term. It doesn't really matter as long as you recognize that you're identifying something different, but it's not just an acceleration of punk. It's a new zeitgeist.
Yeah. I think that, Ben, you explained it to me the best right there, and I kind of understand it. It's not all the way hardcore. It's not all the way punk. So I would have called it hardcore punk, but hey, what can you do? Dan Sant, what is your take on this?
The one thing that I feel is especially interesting after Daniel has brought up that first generation punk had a mass exodus. And it did in the UK as well. Hence, you know, UK 82 rallying back against the mass exodus of everyone saying punk was dead. But what I feel like this 1.5 is born out of is the fact that, yes, lots of people moved on from punk, and especially those kind of extremely innovative people that are there for the, you know, the extreme happening of it, and then they move on to something else that is really exciting and on the thing. So the next generation comes in and they think they are doing the exact same thing, and they think they are being punk, but there's a shift with almost like trends within this thing where, you know, one band plays a certain way and someone hears it, oh, I'm going to incorporate a little bit of that into this sound as well. And it's like this natural evolution, like you say. But I don't think people were particularly, on a whole, particularly trying to be, you know, something until they were being something that they were calling hardcore. Do you know what I mean? So this 1.5 lies in a region that can be identified, you know, 35, 40 years later to be like, wow, look, we can intellectualize that there is something very different, and that we can segment that part of the evolution of this to to give it its own, like, you know, Noma and like area. But at the time, I feel like all these bands that were playing this stuff were just doing punk. And until, you know, hardcore as a terminology was bandied around and, you know, championed.
Yeah. I 100% agree with everything you said. There's no way you could know you were taking part of a genre that falls between something that just happened and something that hasn't happened yet until, you know, you've moved significantly forward in time, and then you can look back. I mean, this is a retroactively labeled genre 100%, and there's no way it couldn't be.
Well, okay, but I you know, in principle I agree with what you're saying, but I do want to just point out that, you know, there's a reason why the adolescents are saying we're not going to have spiky hair and wear leather and chains on our album cover. There's a reason why the Germs are saying we're not going to sneer on our album cover. They knew they were doing something different. They were saying punk is fucking tired. Let's take this somewhere new.
Right. There is a stripped down aesthetic.
I do agree that they were definitely doing that in, but I bet you they still categorize themselves as punks.
Most true. Of them. Yeah.
True, yeah.
It's true. Ian MacKay said, we always considered ourselves as the Teen Idols hardcore punk. And we always considered Minor Threat ourselves as Minor Threat hardcore punk. So he puts, you know, the two things that I put into two separate categories. He thinks of them as the same category. So yeah, my point being, everyone you talk to has a different take on it. And one thing I totally forgot to mention that's super important is there's a break between punk and 1.5 in terms of big moneyed interests, like major label interests. You have the Clash, the Ramones, and the Sex Pistols are all major label backed. And then you have the almost complete disappearance of that by the time you get to 1.5. So that's a huge shift. It's like no one cares about us anymore. They've given up on us. We're just going to do this because we love it. You know, there's that vibe.
Actually, okay. Here's another thing just to that underscores that too, which is no one cares about us in terms of like creating mainstream media, but also I don't think you ever heard about mask punk on the news or in the regular newspaper very much at all. There might have been a little thing about the bands or something, you know, but the 1.5ers were making the news with these huge riots with the LAPD showing up. So it was a sense of Dan, you were talking about a happening, you know, there was definitely a sense that something was going on that was bigger than just music.
Okay. I want to leave enough time for us to talk about the end of it because Daniel, that was a thing that you brought up that I thought was really interesting, but let's get into the meat of it before we talk about 1.5 kind of ending. I'd like to go to Daniel as well as Ben, and you just talk about, everyone needs to go check out the playlist. Everyone needs to read the article, but for the listeners that might not get to it, can you just talk about some of the definitive albums of 1.5? You can go, Ben.
If you listen to Rodney on the Rock Volume 1, Side 1, like that is the best fast education in 1.5 you could ever get. It's got a surf feeling, it's got a California feeling. It's bright, it's colorful, it's sunshiny in a way that nothing had been before.
Yeah, and outside of California, I'd say you have DOA, the early years. I know they have an album called Hardcore 81 which confuses the issue greatly for many people, but they really are playing that mid-tempo style that I associate with 1.5, and they started so early anyway. They started 78, and the Canadian Subhumans as well. And then when you move further east, I think one of the greatest, like one of the purest examples of 1.5 would be the album Vicious Circle by the Zero Boys, which is completely created in the image of California. Like they, like all these California bands toured through, they inhaled Flipside and they completely internalized it. And then they kind of altered their sound between their first 7-inch Living in the 80s, which is very punk, almost like a New York Dolls kind of thing, to this hyper fast and still fun and still snotty album, Vicious Circle. So, and Youth Anthems for the New World Order by Reagan Youth is another great one. I'd say the first Teen Idol 7-inch Minor Disturbance EP, the first Dead Kennedys album.
Oh, yeah.
Bad Brains Black Dots, which is their 1979 demo before they get hyper fast. And as far as bands that never made that conversion, Fear the Record would be a good example. I'm just going through the thing right now. DI, the interesting thing about DI is they started in 82, well after the hardcore sound was sort of winning the war. Not that it was a, you know, specifically a war, but that sound, the 1.5 sound was falling out of favor, and then here comes DI and they start making records well into the hardcore era. Naked Ray Gun from Chicago, The Effigies from Chicago.
I think that's a lot of examples. So
yeah, I'm just
right on.
Okay.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to talk about of the meat of this issue, or should we talk about like it kind of, why does 1.5 fade?
Well, I can, go ahead.
Can I ask one thing before we move away from the meat of it? What do you think the importance of the formation of this changing of sound and attempt at distancing from, you know, what would be considered first wave classic punk? Do you think there is anything to do with the terminology, which was rampant at the time, especially on the West Coast, especially from Rodney, called the New Wave?
Well, it's a shift even further away from New Wave. You know, New Wave would be like the light version of punk, whereas 1.5 would be pushing further into the hard and fast direction.
No, that's what I'm saying. Like, do you think there was a strong attempt at distancing from what was being, you know, punk light to a lot of the punks?
Absolutely. I think that's a great point. I think that one of the things that happened is that there was this need to be harder and differentiate. And, you know, that's a very high school kind of concept. It's like, I'm not that, I'm this, you know? And when, as hardcore bubbled up, it was more about suburban high school kids creating their own culture. And they definitely were trying to say, I am not that guy from Valley Girl, you know, I'm doing the real stuff.
Yeah,
and Zach, to answer your question, which is kind of tied into that, I think the reason that it faded has to do with this Dionysian and Apollonian energy. You know, Reagan was elected, and there was kind of a split where there were two ways you could respond to that. You know, you could respond to it by writing a song called, you know, Fuck Authority, which would be the hardcore way, or you could respond to it through greater decadence, which would have been like going down the road that I went, which is like the Gun Club and Salvation Army, and kind of a return to rock and roll basics in a way, to rock music basics. So I think that is, I mean, Ben actually pointed out to me that a lot of people of my generation, there's like a whole contingent that bailed out late 81, early 82. His friend Amy Linden, who's another rock critic. Ben, who were some of the other people?
Jack Rabid from Big Takeover. He talked about getting that Not So Quiet on the Western Front comp in 1982 and being like, holy shit, there are 47 bands and they all fucking sound the same. Fuck this. I mean, he'd said it in a much nicer way. But Tim Sommer, who did the Noise of the Show radio show on WNYU, he was kind of like the New York equivalent of Rodney Bingenheimer for that scene. Like by 82, 83, he was just like, what people care about now is the slamming and the punching each other more than the music. Like there's a, people aren't focusing on the what's happening on stage, and it's just getting old for me. So all these people kind of bail out when there's that transition from 1.5 to hardcore. But I do think, like, if you think about it in just a really broad way, if punk is taking rock and making it extreme, and 1.5 is taking punk and making it extreme, it's inevitable that there's going to be something else, hardcore, that takes 1.5 and makes it extreme. It's just this constant push towards harder and faster that pretty much was inevitable, I think. Do you think that's fair, Daniel? You were there. I wasn't.
Yeah. I think so. And you know, even though I have to say, on reflection, I have a lot more respect for hardcore now than I did at the time that it happened. You know, I see that it was a democratization. It had to do with the fact that this thing was going nationwide. It had to do with the fact that kids from relatively bland suburbs, you know, not like, you know, Clockwork Orange County, which is, you know, this very dark entity. You can see why they created 1.5. But kids from the Valley were doing hardcore. Kids from the Midwest were doing hardcore. It made more sense as a national phenomenon. And I get that.
Yeah.
Okay. Anthony, do you have anything else on this? He's on mute. Oh, there you are.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. No, I think, here's something I wrote up real quick, is that I think if you ask someone in 1991, right, I'm picking an arbitrary year, and you could pick three bands, right? You pick Heroin, Earth Crisis, Bikini Kill. They're all hardcore bands, right? There's no nuance. All those bands are completely different. They're entrenched in different things. And we could, like, if it was Wikipedia, maybe it gets put into this bucket. We'll use that term again, right? But I think it's really important to look into the nuance and to sort of like the cultural importance of why these things happened. And I think there's a lot of value in understanding sort of this in-between genre. And also, I mean, what's kind of interesting is that I think the Germs are such an outlier because they're almost an art project, but they're so almost guttural and seemingly like very like shambolic or something. And it's like, I don't think many bands have been able to do that. I mean, you look at the cover of the LP and it's almost this, like, you know, it's got avant-garde type. It's this it's like this, I don't know, there's a term for that type of design. It looks like no other hardcore record ever or punk record ever. And so it's like, it's very heady in a sense. And then it's also very guttural. And so I just think it's super interesting and important to create a space where this stuff exists that informed a lot of things and was a jumping off point. And rather than just saying like, oh, it's all hardcore punk or it's all punk rock, you know, it's I really appreciate the time it takes to identify stylistic differences, tempo differences, intentional differences. And yeah, I don't know. I'm just a fan of the piece and I'm a fan of the thinking behind it. So I don't have much to add on that.
No, I think that's great. And I should say, I'm asking those early questions just so you get it out there for the listeners. I'm a huge fan of the article and anything that really puts a spotlight on this stuff, which is some of the greatest music ever created in the history of music, in my opinion, is right.
My opinion too.
Actually, totally. Let me backtrack real quick. I think when you create a hive mind, when you create, like, when you can take these like very seemingly fragmented ideas and then you tie them into something that is all coming from sort of like the same impulse of like, we want to do something different, but why are they doing it? And then you can culturally ground it. I think that's so important. And it creates new value. And then you can look at the playlist and see the through lines and listen to it in a different way. My favorite thing about music journalism in general is that like great music journalism can make me hear something that I've heard 1,000 times and hear it in a different light And I think that's why this is important. And that's what I took out of it. Like it made me dig back into records that I was very familiar with and hear them differently. So that's kind of like, that's my praise for this.
That's awesome. That's like, that's like the best thing we could hope for people to do is either discover stuff that they had. You know how many people said, I've never heard of the Consumers in my life, but now I'm a fan mm-hmm. because of your article and your playlist. Cause it's they're the very first example of 1.5 that we can think of. So it's the first thing you hear on the playlist. And it's like, that's fucking awesome. Like, and I think the only thing I would want to add to this entire discussion is sort of what the legacy of 1.5 is. Because you know, it fell out of favor by 82, 83, 84, but it never really went away. And I think that components of it bubble up back again with, the Offspring in 1994 with the album Smash, where you can hear the TSOL and Agent Orange influences in their music. And it's so funny that ends up being the biggest selling record on an independent label in recorded music history. It's almost like the stuff that was made in 1980 in California, like it just didn't have a chance to be heard, but it had that ability to captivate, you know, the masses. Although I would say the Offspring are much more radio friendly than the stuff that happened 10 years earlier. But I think that, you know, the whole skate, surf, punk Warp Tour culture completely owes its entire existence to these bands we're talking about, whether or not you like them. But like that's a huge legacy. So
yeah. I mean, I would think that those bands that blew up in the early 90s, most of them, at least the California bands, they harken back to all this stuff as their main influences. You've always thought that, haven't you, Ben? Like Pennywise is gonna like say Adolescence and TSOL are their influences.
Oh, I mean, one of them is one of those big bands from the 90s is Bad Religion, who was, you know, a 1.5 band in the early 80s, as well as Descendants, you know. So even some of the bands themselves, very few of them made that leap to, you know, greater audiences, 15 years later when the rest of the world caught up with them. But,
it makes me think that one thing we didn't exactly get into in the piece, we sort of, you know, danced around it, but I wonder if 1.5 is the first really explicitly suburban music phenomenon where it's not tied to any of the big American cities and it's suburban kids telling you what their lifestyle is really like, you know. And I think that might be part of the reason why here we are 40 years later, we're still talking about the Circle Jerks, we're still talking about the Adolescents. I mean, that alone is kind of crazy.
Well, yeah. that was something I was going to bring up, like, because the piece, you know, is California centric, not entirely, but you know, a lot of this happened here, and you know, first person witnessing it, you know, and the people that you can interview about it, etc., have really strengthened the argument. But the one thing I was going to, you know, kind of, when you think of punk, first wave punk, you think of New York City and London, you know, mm-hmm. primarily. And this was those two epicenters, like the bleed going out across all the other places that weren't those places, is something that I got from reading this too. And it's interesting that you just said that too.
Yeah, and there's something to be said about, I didn't grow up in the suburbs. I grew up in, well, actually, both of us grew up in the middle of LA, but man, there's something about the Adolescence that completely rings true with me as a kid. Like, there's a certain hopelessness living in a place with cookie cutter houses where you're expected to conform. The hyper conservative Orange County, latchkey kids, the product of divorced parents, really no future in sight. I mean, it's almost like a petri dish that where this kind of thing had to happen.
Yeah.
And yeah. So, and it is neat that, like, you know, it was never cool to be from the suburbs. And so maybe when this stuff started bubbling up, it gave, you know, a lot of kids something to identify with, and that's cool.
We got a new, I have a new writing challenge for y'all.
Let's hear it.
Okay. What's the, can we agree that the Ramones invented poppy punk, right? Like we can all agree on that, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And they're from Queens or New York, right?
Yep.
Why then did that not become the hub of that style of music and it became California? I think that's super interesting. We don't need an answer. This is a new article for you.
What I would like to hear you guys break out is Ben puts everything into this giant pop punk bucket, but like there's so much difference between Pennywise and Green Day, you know? Like if we're breaking out 1.5, there has to be a differentiation there.
And that's fair. And I think that's totally fair and valid. And I think when I listen to Pennywise, I hear 1.5 influences that I don't hear when I listen to Green Day. So yeah.
Yeah, so maybe there's a through line. We got to do that.
That'll be my article on shorts metal. That's a different one.
Anthony, I want to address. I actually was as told to for Dee Ramone's autobiography, and mm-hmm. I think I might have the answer a little. Oh, bit
about I love what, it. That's amazing.
I think that the Ramones were there was something suburban about them. I mean, first of all, Queens is not Greenwich Village, sure. You know, and also Dee Dee himself grew up in suburban Germany because he was an army brat. I think that their sensibility was like, you know, it was very formed by the Archies and, you know, all that plastic rock stuff that was happening. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why they came out to California and, you know, made a big deal of it and hooked up with Phil Spector. I mean, they had a California thing going, not right. Explicitly, but it was there.
Yeah. Rockaway Beach, obviously that's about a beach in New York, but it's like, we're going to the beach. And also they covered California Sun, of course, not, right. That's not by a California band, but it's really like, yeah, they love the Beach Boys. So there was something California about them. That's true, huh?
Sure. And their look has like cruising kind of vibes. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I just think it's funny that they didn't inspire, 27 million copycats in the, you know, from Rockaway or Queens or New Jersey, you know, anywhere coastal, right? Rhode Island to copy their style. It translated to California more, which is really funny, you know, like
that's interesting.
You know, there's almost no definitive pop punk band from the East Coast at all. Huh. Right? Like that's pretty wild.
Where are the Barracudas from?
The singer is Canadian, but they're UK based. But I can think of one from the East Coast. Aren't the Queers from like Vermont or New Hampshire?
They're from New Hampshire, yeah.
Okay.
And I guess the Boston's if you strip away the horns, but that's like kind of it, right?
But going back to 1.5, I think the biggest influence on 1.5, absolutely, I'll say this definitively, from the first generation punk scene was the Damned. I mean, the Stimulators.
Sure.
Were inspired by seeing the Damned.
The Bad Brains, well, everybody.
The Bad Brains, too. Almost every LA band was inspired by the Damned who came to LA in 77. The Sex Pistols skipped LA, and that would have been 70. That was 78 anyway. So it's like, and they were like the fastest and wildest of that bit of that grouping of, you know, major first generation punk bands. So that's a part of the story, too.
I mean, you know, thinking about Anthony's setup there, the Pistols are just so English. I mean, they're almost like something out of a Dickens novel. And you could see why you couldn't really. I think that LA people struggled to imitate them and could not pull it off. And that's part of why 1.5 happened, actually. And that's kind of there in the piece, that there was this anxiety of influence. Like, how are we going to outdo the Pistols? Well, you're not. You know, you're going to have to figure out your own thing. Mm-hmm.
I love that term anxiety of influence, because you get a record like We Don't Need the English by the Bags, where Alice Bag is literally singing in an English accent. And then you get Let's Get Rid of New York by the Randoms. And then the other side of it is ABCD, which sounds exactly like Looking for a Kiss by the New York Dolls. And then you get This is Boston, Not LA. It's like LA is so dominant with this hardcore thing by 82 with Black Flag and Circle Jerks touring their asses off that in order for the Boston scene to differentiate itself, it has to point to LA and make it, you know, say we're not that, you know, if nothing was going on in LA, it wouldn't even be in the title of the record in the first place. So that term anxiety of influence, you see that pop up over and over again.
I think that's a great spot to end. Do you guys feel like the article has been well represented?
Yeah, very much. This was a blast.
I'd like to say if you want to listen to the playlist, it's on Spotify. It's called 1.5 and then in parentheses, the hidden genre between punk and hardcore. And then again, to read the article, it's on pleasekillme.com and it's entitled The Zone in Between, a Hidden Rock and Roll Genre.
We'll also hook the playlist up on the 185 Miles South website where all the other playlists are. So everyone can check it there if they aren't super savvy at searching on Spotify.
Well, Zach, you've got to make Ben drop 4 songs from it.
Oh, that's right. Ben, get that list down from 189 to 185, motherfucker.
Oh, I see where you're going with that.
You know? All right. Well, you guys have been great. Thank you so much for your time, Daniel.
Thanks, Andy. Fellas. Thank you.
This segment, the day before a classic album was recorded, the singer of that band was abducted by a UFO. They're left with no singer. You're allowed to pick anyone from any time period to fill in and sing on that record. So in our initial version of this, we're doing Cro-Mag's Age of Quarrel. John Joseph has been abducted by a UFO the day before they hit the studio to record this album. And we're going to discuss who we would want to take John Joseph's place if that actually occurred. And again, it doesn't have to be from the same time period. If you want to choose a singer of Mind Force, which would be a great choice, you can do that. But Anthony Pappalardo, let's go to you. Who would you take?
Well, there's this guy. He's a very tribal singer. He kind of channels things that are pretty interesting. A lot of people call him Jay Devil. Jonathan Davis is his moniker from Korn. That dude's really cool. He's like a HR Geiger microphone stand.
No, I think
I wouldn't pick him.
You wanted him to fill in on bass for Harley, so like he could play down next to his Vans.
Yeah, no, that's Fieldy.
Yeah, that's Fieldy, dude. And there's also Head. There's another guy in that band named Head. But I'm not picking any of them. I'm going to pick. I don't want to make light of this. I want to say that this person specifically, who I think is one of the best hardcore front men to ever do it, front people, right? Eddie Pomponio, Eddie Sutton, right? Like Eddie Leeway, that dude's amazing. He's battling cancer right now. I believe he has a GoFundMe. Please help him out. Like that dude's so... I don't know how to explain, like, for me, like, Leeway is a band that, like, one of the first live bands I ever saw that just blew me away of how charismatic he was. Now, if we were going to say, okay, John Joseph isn't singing on Age of Quarrel, who else better to step in with charisma, someone who can, like, tell those urban tales, someone who just has that swagger, and the voice, you know? And so Eddie Leeway is like my analog for like any record I think that sucks. And I'm like, well, what if Eddie Leeway did that? And then quick story, I was at a Coney Island High one night and I just went in, like I was in New York. I didn't live in New York at the time and paid my $8 and go in. And I just hear like, some kind of like metal mosh or whatever, like prison metal. And then all of a sudden I see fucking this dude ripping it, singing for Marauder. And I was like, what the fuck? Like fucking Eddie fucking Sutton sings for Marauder. It was the coolest thing I've ever seen. And the way he presented himself, like, just such a, I don't know how to explain, like, that dude in his prime, or that dude when he's inspired, is just like such a presence. And so I think if we had to replace, and also I just want to say, like, I want to step back, like, Age of Quarrel is one of the greatest records, not one of the greatest hardcore records, one of the greatest musical accomplishments ever. And it's almost like you can't replace John Joseph, but if you had to, which is what this segment is about, I'd love to see Eddie Pomponio do that. That dude's, he's fucking incredible. What a showman, right? Like, what a range, and what, I don't know. I think no one else could tell those, could tap into those lyrics and do it the same way and do it interesting and do it with range than him. So that's, you know, if John Joseph was picked up by a UFO, which wouldn't happen because we're in a flat earth, so that wouldn't happen. But if that did happen, then yeah, I want Eddie Sutton to step up.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with you here, Anthony. That's my choice as well. And there's other people that I thought about that could fill in. Like, you tossed out Mike Muir today, and I was thinking about it. I was like, ooh, that would be ill.
Like, it'd be kind of good, right?
Yeah, because, like, in a live setting, I mean, Mike Muir is so good. His vocal has enough range, but, you know, and Roger would be great too. And then if we're doing all time, I love the Sarah Mind Force a lot. Like, I wasn't joking when I brought that up. I think you could transport him maybe. Just a lot of options. Roger Agnostic Front, kind of a no-brainer. But it comes down to Malfunction. And I need someone that can pull that off. And if it's not JJ on that day when he busted out those magical notes on Age of Quarrel, I think Eddie's the only answer. He's like,
I think Eddie might be better. I'm just going to put it right there. Like, just think about, like, Malfunction, like, when you got to sing it out with that dude in the skeleton outfit. Come on. Knee pads. Come on.
Yeah. For that song, he might have killed it even more. I don't think anyone could do it better than John Joseph on that day. But if I had to choose someone else, it would be Eddie. Ben, what's your take on this?
I think that if Eddie were the singer on that record, it would be just as good as it is. I don't know if it would be better. It would be better than any Leeway record. And so, great choice is basically what I'm saying. My answer is HR. And the reason is because I think Cro-Mags were so heavily influenced by the Bad Brains that having the singer of the Bad Brains sing for the record would be wild. And it's almost like right around the same time Bad Brains put out Eye Against Eye, which is a little bit more rock or metallic than their previous material. But Age of Quarrel is, you know, quite metallic too. And it kind of does that better than Eye Against Eye musically. Mm-hmm. So if you put HR in there, it would be like, I think it would actually make it a better record. Like, it, I mean, no diss on the record as it is now. It's one of my favorite records ever, but my God, if HR sang on Age of Quarrel, and I think he would do Malfunction justice, because Bad Brains have slow songs and he sounds good on those too. So
yeah, well, HR is a great choice. HR is a great choice, because just imagine him singing like We Gotta Know when it kicks in. Like, that is the Bad Brains influence on the way that John Joseph is singing, you know? So it would be wild to hear HR do it. Daniel, sorry for cutting you off. Let's go to you.
Yeah. I was going to say on the mouth, it's essentially an HR like worship moment anyway on the Malfunction part.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, isn't We Gotta Know almost like a redo, like a 2.0 of Pay to Come? Like, it's the same.
Very, very similar. Daniel, what would be your choice?
I'd go with Dr. Anthony Fauci. All right. I would go with Raymond Capo. I think it would be really interesting to hear this LP with that production, with that wild caged animal vocal.
Okay, what version Ray Capo, pull Ray Capo off a record. What Ray Capo are we getting?
Break Down the Walls. I think Break Down the Walls, Ray Capo matches this better than We're Not In This Alone, Ray. Although my favorite Ray is We're Not In This Alone. So it's interesting, but I'm going to go Break Down the Walls because I want way more of the buzzsaw. Like, I want it to be malfunction.
You've heard that, though, right?
I really feel that.
That would be ill.
You've heard that, though, right, Daniel? That the Take a Stand Live Youth of Today album that Lost and Found put out, Youth of Today covers Malfunction.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But I'm saying with the NYHC like reverb heavy recording of this, like having Ray's vocals in a pocket over these songs on a very like on one of the best recordings of a hardcore record ever. God, it could just sound different and amazing, you know?
You're right. Because he draws out syllables a lot of the time, and pushes them into the next measure. Like Ray Capo does that a lot. Like he's singing over the music in a good way, and like that would be really cool to hear.
And then he occasionally does those just very clean line out of nowhere, just to differentiate from how growly the rest is. You know,
the final 7-inch version, Ray Capo would be very interesting too when he's a little more tuneful.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a question for everyone. Has the Cro-Mags, has Leeway ever covered the Cro-Mags? No. Has Cro-Mags ever covered Leeway? Yeah, they have.
Well, every single set nowadays.
Yeah.
The intro.
That's all.
Yeah, right on. And to sum up, like, if people want to get the best of the Eddie Leeway performance, Anthony, what was the YouTube show that you shared with us? Because that was
absolutely- I would do that that set at CB's where I believe he's wearing like a Batman shirt and like his voice. CB's is like a magical place where everyone sounds good, but there's certain people where their voice projects through the whole thing. That shit is psycho. Like that's one of the best sets I've ever seen in my life. I believe it's like Leeway at CB's 86 or 87. It's just, I don't know, if I was going to put that into like a time capsule of like what New York City hardcore was, because like, here's the thing, like, and this is no slight to the Cro-Mags, they were too big to play CBs. Like, the Cro-Mags were a Ritz band, you know? In that setting, they, like, Leeway is just owning that place. And that dude's voice, like, I guess it's kind of the same thing that Bratton said about hearing Curtis, of like that dude's voice projected. Like Eddie's voice just is psycho. And that set's incredible.
Yeah, that set's incredible. Also, I saw him 2019, I believe, 2018, 2019 at a bar in San Diego. And he's still got that magic. I mean, he's just one of those guys that, like, you know, there's... We say character in the nicest way because like there's a intangible of their personality that makes them special that can never fade. So if you haven't had a chance to see Eddie in Leeway live, make an effort to do it when shows come back, you know, because these people deserve your respect and they're not going to let you down, in my opinion.
There's a vulnerability to Eddie Sutton. What's his real last name?
Pomponio.
I had no idea. I thought Sutton was his last name.
Yeah. Now I think what's like really interesting about him, it's kind of the same thing as Pete Stahl, is that they were brought up on like Sam Cooke or like soulful singers. And they're trying to translate that into hardcore. And like Eddie's always talking about like love and like, I think that vulnerability is really interesting, and that dude's got pipes, you know, like same way Pete Stahl, like P-Stall has pipes, and that's just, I don't know, it adds something.
Yeah, true gems. So yeah, that's our take. And let us know who you would pick, because that's interesting. Hit us up on the gram.
Yeah, for real. Tell us.
Yep, tell us we got it wrong, because we probably did, in your opinion, man.
But you know what? There's things called fun facts and then unfun facts.
Fun facts and then unfun facts.
Okay, we're going to go into a fun fact. Got Anthony Pappalardo here. And Anthony, one thing we've mentioned a couple times on the podcast was the second In My Eyes LP was sped up in the studio without you knowing it. And I think you have confirmed that is correct over text, but we wanted you to hash it out here to give us the whole story.
Yeah, so that record, it's almost like the Chinese Democracy of hardcore records. It was recorded in, like, I believe 5 studios, which is really stupid. Basically, the short story is that those songs were written, mostly written with me and Luke, the drummer. And we would just go into the rehearsal space that we had in South Boston. And we had them pretty tight. And then it was time to record the record. And, you know, this is not a slight to Damien, but he, you know, Explosion was kind of jumping off at the same time. So Brian McTernan was leaving Boston, moving back to DC. So what happened was we had done the raw tracks at this studio behind the Middle East, which is like a pretty famous Middle East cafe, famous venue in Boston at this place. I forget the name of it. Doesn't matter. We did the drums and the guitar there. And then we had the skeletons of the songs, and then Brian moved back and he had like a Salad Days in Maryland, and Damien went down there. He lived in Philadelphia at the time, or he was back in Philadelphia at the time. And we were trying to piece together this record. And at some point it came together. We had like all these pieces. I played bass on some stuff. It felt like a record. And it was time for Pete to do his vocals. And we went to this place called the Magic Egg, which was back in Boston. And it was a really interesting studio. I don't have the discogs up of what's recorded there. It's a very boomy studio, and people would go record there because you could get kind of like the Albini sound. It was a very tall studio. It's like 3 stories tall. So you put the room mics up and you get the Albini drum sound or whatever. No idea why we recorded there. Pete goes back in there and it's time to do his vocals. And I'm noticing, I'm like, wow, this sounds fast. And Brian just said, like, don't worry about it. Like, just hold a handheld mic. Like, don't worry about a spit guard or whatever. And Pete does his thing. And I think he tracked it in like a day or whatever. So I get the thing back, and for some reason, I go to play along with it, and everything's a half step off, right? I'm like, wait a minute, the open chord doesn't make sense. And I call Brian. I'm like, hey, man, what's going on? He's like, oh, that performance just, it was too tight. I sped it up. And so what I think, which he should have told me, which is totally wild, but the MI's demo was no click track, right? It was just go in, blast it out. And I guess why I want to talk about this is because I don't think hardcore of that style should be done to a click track. I think it restrains the drummer and it makes them too conscious. Like, you know, everyone's favorite rock record, not mine, but is like Appetite for Destruction, right? If you start a metronome at any one of those songs at whatever BPMs that is, by the end of the song, it's totally different. Because they need to breathe. They need to do whatever. I think it's the same thing. You could do that with Screaming for Change. And I think when you restrain a drummer trying to play a beat that actually is technically not correct, like a fast beat, it fucks with their head. Luke did that record to a click track almost by himself. It was insane. And I think it's same thing with the MI's, the first record. It sounded too stiff. It was very, it starts to become sterile. So Brian being, a very astute person, his solution was to speed it up. So I didn't, I noticed it then. I didn't give a shit. Sped it up, whatever. Years later, this band from South America hits me up and they're like, can you please explain how you play this song? Because it was one of the songs that was like a lot of open chords and they couldn't figure out like this, because it had like I think it's the song Perspective. None of it made sense to them because it's like most of the chords are open and they would be going to like the first fret or whatever. And they were acting like it was like they're trying to play like a weather report song or something. Right. And I was like, I'm like, no, dude. Like, and I was like, oh shit, you got to tune like a half step up. So that record, the music sped up and then the vocal delivery was recorded to the more sped up thing to get like the best performance out of Pete. But so if you, not that anyone, Todd Jones, he's actually the only person who noticed, which is really funny. Because I used to talk to him quite a bit, and he was like, "What? This is so weird. These songs don't make any sense." And I was like, "No, it's like a half step up." And then later I learned, I believe Wig Out was recorded that way as well. So yeah, it's just a kind of a strange thing, but it was just to get more energy out of the performance because. Both of those records, they sound so sterile. And like the first MI's record, I can't even listen to because it sounds like, it sounds like it was recorded by bots or something. Like I can't fuck with it. But the second one, yeah, it is sped up, which is wild.
Yeah, I'm glad you could confirm that. I always heard a rumor that one of the later 7 Seconds was actually up a half step as well, just because Kevin thought his voice went better with it. But I don't know which one, and I never bothered to go in and check. Ben, that's a project for you. How about that?
I have a question, Anthony.
Yeah, sure.
Would you prefer that album if he hadn't sped it up? Do you think it would have the end product would have been better had he not sped up that record?
No, I think it would have been better if the bass was more prominent because it sounds like an AC/DC record. It's really weird. That record's super weird. I like the energy of it. I think it's cool or whatever. Like it's like my favorite MI's recording, but it just sounds like it doesn't sound like, I don't know. I think for a record of that style to sound good, it almost needs to sound like it was recorded live, And I understand what Brian was doing. Like he was trying to learn how to be a producer or at that point, even like hone his craft. But I think he would have been better served to hone his craft with like the Promise Ring rather than us, like it was just the wrong, it's the wrong band to try to do it, And yeah, I mean, I think that record would have been better if it was just a live performance, to be honest, because my justification for that is like my favorite In My Eyes recording is on the Super Soul comp that like probably not a lot of people have heard. It's the recording of Welcome to Boston on that, which was live in a radio studio. I believe it was like WERS. It was some college radio station. It sounded really good in there. And then we were like, oh, keep running the DAT. We're going to just run through some songs. And we had just written Welcome to Boston. We ripped through that. And it sounded great. And like, I think that I wish the whole record sound like that, like, I don't think it needed to be sped up, to be quite honest. I think we just needed to be organic rather than, a hardcore record shouldn't take a week.
Yeah.
You just needed more Sega Genesis samples.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Luckily didn't get sued for that. So that's cool.
I think we should do a whole segment sometime on the Super Soul comp because that is an interesting one at an interesting time. And it has some of my favorite songs on it. Like that Meme Strike song, their version of that song on that record is one of my favorite things ever. So let's do that sometime in the future. But Anthony, thanks for sharing. And this is our fun fact segment. Hopefully we can top it sometime. Ben, what do you
have? Yeah, Anthony, do you know about what happened with Rock for Light, the Bad Brains album? So, something really similar. So to my understanding, that album was produced by Rick Ocasek from The Cars, came out in 1983. Then in 1991, maybe, they decided to, I don't know if it was Rick and HR, it was with the permission of the participation of the band, they sped the whole record up. They sped it all up, which is so weird because it's already the fucking fastest band in the world with a guy who has a chipmunk voice. And I say that in the nicest way possible. I love the Bad Brains, but it's like, of all the bands that would need to be sped up, the fucking Bad Brains. And then there's still earlier editions of that album from before they sped it up. Obviously the original release, but I remember buying like the German version of the CD because it was from before they sped it up. And now they're finally reissuing it this year at the correct normal speed that it was originally. So,
God. I can tell you like a very vivid recollection of that. So I only had Rock for Light on the PVC records, I believe it's called, right? Like that pressing. And that's how I knew that record. It sounded great. And my friend who had, he was going to Burlington College in Vermont. He was like, oh, come visit me. I'll pick you up or whatever. So we drive up there and he puts in the CD. And I was like, what the fuck is, dude, is there something wrong with your stereo? He's like, there's something wrong with you. And then he was A-B-ing it to other stuff. He's like, no, I'm going to play Judge. You know, bringing it down. Yeah, it sounds normal. Put Rock for Life back in. I'm like, no, dude, this sounds like the Chipmunks. This is not right. And we were fighting the whole way up. But we didn't learn until, I mean, this was like 95 or something. We didn't know till way later that was sped up. And like, I was just familiar with the regular version, you know?
That's mind blowing to me. I never heard that until right now. Holy shit.
It's so noticeable. Like if you A-B it, it's almost like two different records. It's like, it's almost like you're playing it on 45. It's really interesting.
Yeah. I think it might be a whole step up. So if you're playing it, playing along on guitar, it'd be two frets higher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. So. Wait, two fun facts for the price of one. How about that?
And so are these records. Collector's Bargain Corner.
All right, I wanted to do a little segment about some records that I see on Discogs all the time that are super cheap and super awesome. So if you're someone out there that's trying to like build up your record collection, you want it to be super solid, but you don't want to blow big bucks on building it, these are some great albums that rule and are not going to break the bank. The first one I wanted to mention was the Run For Your Fucking Life self-titled LP. This record rules. It came out on Gloom Records in the year 2000, and it is just a straight rager. If you're into tragedy like that ilk, it's like tragedy with a little bit less melody and maybe a little more manic in parts, but it's a straight rager all the way through. If you live in Europe, you're extra stoked because you can get this for $2, €3, €2, €3. If you're in Canada, it's like $7. In the US, you know, it's a $10 record or cheaper. Put it on your list. You can find it in the $5 to $10 range all the time. And this is a great one to have in your collection. Dan, you love this one, don't you?
Yeah. The tragedy reference is very on point, but it's like if tragedy came from San Diego, because there is something very San Diego about it.
That's right.
Something very Gravity Records hits tragedy in there. And, you know, and 3-1-G-ish as well. It's so fucking good. And you know what the best thing about this LP is? You can listen to it on 45 or 33, and both are amazing. For real.
Yeah, but for real. Get this record if you want to build your record collection. I think it's a great addition. It is not going to break the bank. And that is the Record Collector Bargain Corner. What's up?
You know, son, you're not a kid anymore.
Oh, no. I go to
shows.
Dad, I already know all this stuff.
Well, they don't teach you about everything
at shows.
Okay, Mr. Samari Bands? So just listen. When boys and girls get a little older, they start getting
interested in punk and hardcore subgenres. Starter kit.
All right, we're doing a starter kit, and Ben is going to describe to us. Nail it down, Ben. What starter kit are you giving us?
I'm going to do the early days of the DC scene. So roughly from the beginning of the Bad Brains to the breakup of Minor Threat. So 78, 79, all the way to the end of 83. I think that's like a good period. You know, that's a good... Things changed a lot in DC after, you know, Minor Threat. You have the Revolution Summer thing happening in 85. So that could be its own thing. So I'm just talking about these early days.
Early days of DC hardcore. Hit it, Ben.
Or DC, you know, 1.5, I would say pre-hardcore, before it was solidified. So, you know, Bad Brains recorded this demo in 78, and it's really slow. But by the time they record the next demo in 79, the tempos are faster, still not to where they're going to be. And they record an entire album's worth of material at Don Zientara's house, with HR standing in the backyard. And you know, neighborhood kids are seeing this guy yelling into a microphone. They don't hear the music because the music's happening inside, you know, he's wearing headphones, and they're just like, who is this lunatic? And so that gets released many, many, many years later, like I want to say 95 or 96, as Black Dots on Caroline Records. But this is really the Bad Brains 1979 demo, and it's incredible. And there's Rollins and Ian MacKaye love talking about, like, what would have happened if that came out in 1979 as a full album, like a proper album, because it's so well recorded. It does not sound like a demo. It sounds like a legit great album, and it was all recorded live, which is just insane because it's so good. So I'd say start with that. And the two standout tracks I'm gonna say are Band in DC and Pay to Come. I think those are songs that they're really known for. And then moving on from that, we're going into 1980 with the Discord number one, the Teen Idols Minor Disturbance EP. And so this is Ian MacKaye on bass before he's a singer, Jeff Nelson, later of Minor Threat, on drums. And then you have Nathan on vocals, who then ends up in DC Youth Brigade after that. And so, this record is great. It kind of hints at things to come for at least three of the members. I think their guitarist kind of disappeared after this. The song Teen Idols and the song Sneakers would be the standout tracks on this. And it's famous for the record cover because you have someone making fists with their arm in an X with X's on their hands. And this is kind of before that became synonymous with straight edges of movement or anything like that. And if you want to know why and how that the whole X thing happened, you can read my article, of course. Got to plug that. But it's a really fun listen. It's like there's a fun kind of adolescent... you know, all the stuff was written while I were still in high school, vibe to it that sort of disappears with my next pick, which is Minor Threat. And if you're listening to this podcast, you know who Minor Threat is, and you already own the fucking, at least you own the CD with all the songs, but how could I not put them on the list? That would be ridiculous. So Minor Threat complete discography, fuck it. I asked if I had permission to, you know, use a complete discography as an album instead of having to choose. You know, it's like a Sophie's Choice, trying to choose which Minor Threat is the most representative one.
Yeah. Ben, just to explain that, like, this is a starter kit, right? For people that want to understand a subgenre. So basically, you know, you can use anything that's accessible to the people, right? Like, that's all.
And that thing has been a starter kit for most people getting into punk and hardcore from early 90s on.
Yeah, it's mostly the starter kit for the whole thing for everyone whenever you enter.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I'd say not only is this the early DC era starter kit choice, but if I was to make a starter kit for all of punk and hardcore, this would be on it as well. Yes, of course. So I'd say I'm going to pick the song Seeing Red and the song Think Again. So you get a taste of that 81 era with Seeing Red, which is on their first self-titled 7-inch. And then that 83 era from Out of Step, we have Think Again. And you can see just in those two songs, musical progression from simple and hard and fast to, you know, the tempos kind of moving around and a little bit more musical and a little bit more melodic. And the interesting thing about Seeing Red is the music was written by Jeff Nelson, the drummer, and it's the only Minor Threat song that he wrote, I believe. And I thought for the longest time he wrote the lyrics too, but nope, Ian MacKaye wrote those lyrics. So my fourth choice would be the greatest split record ever recorded, the Faith Void split LP, also on Discord, which came out in 1982. And obviously I'm going to have to pick one song from each side. So I'm picking, in honor of Anthony Pappalardo and the Sped Up In My Eyes LP, I'm picking What's Wrong With Me by Faith, which was covered by In My Eyes. And then for Void, I'm picking My Rules, which is a different version of this appears on the Flex Your Head comp. And I mean, if you could say, just get the Flex Your Head comp and you'd hear what all these bands, Bad Brains excluded, sound like, but you know, let's pick these individual records instead of just saying by the Flex Your Head comp. But Void is fucking wild. I think Faith is kind of more in the, was crafted in the vision of Minor Threat. It's kind of what's Alex, Ian's younger brother, Alec, is the singer, who, by the way, is the guy with the X's on the hands on the Teen Idols record and the bald head looking down on the Minor Threat record. So he's like the model, literally the model for DC of this era. And so Faith is a little bit more traditional, straightforward hardcore. Void is completely singular. They don't sound anything like, they don't sound like anyone else. And this song I first heard on the Rodney on the Rock show when Sonic Youth were guest hosting, because Rodney was out of town or something, and they played this song, and I'm like, this is so fucking good. I can't believe how good this is. And for my last choice, I'm going Scream from their, I'm going to go their first album, which came out in 83. I think it might have been recorded in 82, came out in 83 on Discord, and it's called Still Screaming. And Scream is famous for being a band that Dave Grohl played drums in, but this is pre-Dave Grohl era. Kent Stacks on drums, who's also an amazing drummer. And Came Without Warning is the first song on that, and Solidarity is a little bit more sing-songy, but also hyper-fast. And I think of Scream as sort of a combination of the Damned and Minor Threat, and almost like probably coincidentally sounds similar to 7 Seconds, but the musicianship is so top-notch. They were more like, they seem more like adults who like really knew how to play their instruments than a lot of other bands in that scene. So you can't go wrong with any of these. I think that's it.
Well, right on. Daniel, you are an aficionado of this early DC sound. How do you feel Ben Starter Kid is for someone that has never been exposed to this genre?
Oh, it's pretty perfect. Like, I mean, I like that he did it in a little bit of a chronological manner. So you can, but you're also being exposed to the basically at least four of them, you know, the kind of Mount Rushmore-y bands when you think of the very early DC. I was thinking maybe SOA would have been on there, but I can also see why they're not with the other choices, you know?
Yeah, originally I was going to have Government Issue, a song off of their Boycott Stab record, but I couldn't. I took them off and I put Teen Idols on, because I think Government Issue gets very interesting a little bit later on. Like, at this point, they're a fun, fast hardcore band. But then they start going into interesting directions more in the mid to late 80s.
Yeah,
but also a great band.
What's great is that it's the starter kit, right? So this is like, check these out, which it also will provide a level of interest where it's like, this band came before this all important, encompassing genius band. Do you know what I mean? It's like, here's the fun groundswell before this insane, like, scorched earth, minor threat, atom bomb, you know?
Yeah, you have to have it because of who it is and when it is. But also, like, you know, the point of the starter kits is you're going to get into this stuff if you aren't already, and there is so much more for you to figure out on your own, right? Like, yeah. none of the areas or the genres we're doing starter kits on is like, well, there was 5 good releases from this ever. This is all you need. No, it's a starter kit, you know? Anthony Pappalardo, how did you feel about this one?
I mean, the starter kit's perfect. The only thing I would add is sort of like a couple layers. There's kind of bands that are adjacent that are not sort of part of like the capital D, capital C hardcore scene, you know, like we're talking United Mutation or sort of these antagonistic bands, which I think, you know, No Trend, like Numero Group put out that box set. I'm not the biggest fan, but I do think it is super interesting that you have bands that are reacting to like the, how sort of, you know, it's like, it's kind of like if you look at Youth of Today or whatever, right? Like someone comes up with the code of something and then someone has to press against it. I think No Trend is pretty interesting at the same time to be like tapping into PIL or Flipper or whatever. And so I think like, it's almost like an alternative starter kit to look at like the bands that were pushing against that. I'd add Black Market Baby, that I think Dr. Strange put out that like a compilation of like all their early stuff. I think that's pretty interesting stuff. It's not essential. No slight to Black Market Baby, but I think that's interesting. And then also the only thing I'd add is that I have such reverence for Henry Rollins. When he had the opportunity to, he's kind of like the OG reissue person. You know, when he started that label Infinite Zero, which I believe was with Rick Rubin, he was putting things in print that weren't in print. So that like he put all the Gang of Four records, the first two Gang of Four records in print and Devo records that weren't in print. I thought that was really cool. And then later, he did the, and pardon me if I'm wrong on this, but I believe it was the 30 Seconds Over DC comp. So that's like the genre, sort of like the people before what we're talking about. So if you want to dig back a little more, and that was on Limp, initially issued on Limp Records, which is, was it the filler 7-inch was a split release with Limp Records, right?
Yeah, like Skip Groff.
Skip Groff, right?
Yeah.
So that one that has like the Slicky Boys and like some interesting stuff. So if you want to dig back, definitely not a starter kit, but if you're like, what's before the starter kit, that record's pretty interesting. And Rollins, he didn't do it on Infinite Zero. He did it on like his other imprint, but I think that's cool that I really appreciate that he identified things that were important to him that weren't existing and keeping them in print. So that stuff exists out there. But yeah, I just think, I think that's such, I mean, that scene's going to be defined by Straight Edge in the sense of like, that's the most important thing that happened, but also there's people pushing against it. And I think that tension is so important. And then what happens just a couple years after that is so important. So, you know, like it's kind of like what Ben said, like you could just get Flex Your Head and you have your introduction to the family tree. And that's amazing too. Like they're pretty much everything splines off that. So yeah, no, I think it's perfect.
I love it. The early DC punk and hardcore starter kit. Killer job, Ben. And we'll do another one soon.
I'm taking it back to the old school because I'm an old fool.
I'm taking it back to the old school because I'm an old fool.
Yo, what's up, motherfuckers? Old school. Old School Spotlight.
Okay, we have Dan Sant, we have Bedge, and we have the legend. Episode 1, Joe Rivas. All right, we are doing the exploited Dead Cities 7-inch. Daniel, let's go to you.
Could you have a more perfect sounding record for the time period and the genre of music that it is? It's perfection. Dead Cities is aggressive, but while being catchy as fuck, the recording is amazing. The UK 82, like, straight ahead, just onslaught is incredible. Then you flip the record, you've got a very tuneful, almost new wave version of UK 82 sound. Hitler's in the Charts Again, so good. Like, an amazingly, like I say, new wave, like very nouveau punk channeled through the Exploited's aggression and sound, but it is very much like a little change of gear for them. And then you've got Class War, which, I mean, I'm sewing my front patch on, my back patch, I'm getting the gelatin out for my hair. Actually, go vegan. I'm not. I got to say, this is an incredible, and the artwork's incredible with the, you know, the red and white, almost like newsprint looking. It's perfect. Lyrically, it's on point. Like, people will joke about Watty being, I mean, they'll somewhat joke about Watty in a sense of, because his Glaswegian accent is so thick that it may sound like, oh, he's wasted. No, this is a very smart, adept lyricist writing fucking great punk bangers. Shout out to Big John from Exploited and Big John's bum on the back. Gonna have to just say that this is classic, and I'm really glad we're talking about it. And I'm really excited to hear what you three think.
I absolutely loved it. Like you said, the recording is just great. It sounds so good and clear, and it was really refreshing to hear like this style on something sounding so bright. Because, yeah, Dead Cities, Class War, these are raging UK 82 songs, perfect for the genre. But to me, the real highlight is Hitler's in the Charts Again. It gives me real like UK subs vibes of like their best stuff. So I'm not catching the new wave as much as you, as more so it's just like UK subs, and Give It To Me All Day, Other Kind of Blues, one of my favorite albums of all time. And this is right in that lane. I absolutely love the 7-inch enough. You know, I hit you up in the group chat and said, Daniel, please choose more like this for us to spotlight on the old shit section. Cause this was absolutely great. I listened to it like 3 times in a row and I loved it. Joe, what's your take on this?
I absolutely love the 7-inch. I had it at one time. It got stolen, so I haven't replaced it. I loved early Exploited, like up through like Punk's Not Dead. But, you know, the later stuff just got really, I don't know, tired, I guess.
Well,
you know?
Let's say when his mohawk got braided. Yeah, you don't need to listen. To
you know, like Drug Squad Man and, you know, Jesus Is Dead, like all that stuff. It just got really trite to me. But this 7-inch is just fantastic. I love all the songs. I see what you're saying about UK subs with the Hitler song. But I think that Dead City song is just fucking just powerful. I love it. I love what it's talking about, too. You know.
Yeah. About the doll, etc.
Yeah, you know, where that might lead us, kind of thing. You know, or lead them. You know, because it's not going to lead us anywhere. But
it's going to lead us to slob.
It's cool too. Like the end of Dead Cities, like it almost sounds like he's saying disease.
Yeah,
which is like kind of like, ooh, is that planned? Like he's like making a connection here.
Yeah, a little slurry in there. Yeah.
Yeah, like the cities are dying of like the disease. Like, oh.
Yeah, the disease is Thatcherism.
Boom. Yeah. Daniel, why you got to bring up old shit? Ben, what was your take on this?
I love it. This is one of the records I grew up on. I mean, you know, probably in the form of a collection or something like that, not the 7-inch itself. But this is the shit. Like, I really enjoy Hitler's in the Charts Again. I would probably like it a little more if I didn't know that Waddy actually has a swastika tattoo. that's no good. I got into the Exploited in junior high, and I always thought of them as the most punk band. You know, we just wanted the most extreme version of what we thought punk was supposed to be, and this was it. Like, we wanted, if you could make your mohawk, you know, 3 feet high, you're better than the guy who can only get 2 feet on his mohawk. Like, you have more spikes on your jacket. Like, it's like cartoonish, but it delivers musically, and it is well recorded. And I think they didn't, you know, they couldn't keep up with the quality. Like if you listen to Let's Start a War, it's real muddy sounding. It doesn't sound as good as this. But I always loved the Exploited, and they're super dumb, but so what? Sometimes it's fun to turn your brain off and listen to just good music, whatever.
You know what album I love that's like later in their catalog is, I love The Massacre. It's like them going like kind of crossover, but it's
full crossover.
Okay. Yeah. But it's got like so much like of this early UK punk sensibility too, like in the songwriting, that it's just a weird mashup. And I absolutely love it. Like, it's like one of those like kind of guilty pleasure records. Cause I don't necessarily think it's objectively good. It just like resonates with me in a weird way, but I like it cause it's so weird.
Yeah, I got that one about a year after it came out, and I thought it, you know me, I thought it sounded too metal, but we loved Punk's Not Dead, we loved Troops of Tomorrow, me and my friend Chuck, rest in peace, best friend in junior high, and then during the Fields of Fire era, when we would, you know, tour the country, we listened to the singles collection a lot in the Jamie's mom's minivan. So we listen to these three songs. Definitely they're in there. So the other thing, I want to take exception to something that Dan said earlier about Waddy's Glaswegian accent. He's from Edinburgh.
Okay. Well,
what do you call that accent? I don't know. Is there a name for that?
He would definitely be, that's funny. I always thought they were from Glasgow.
No, they're from Edinburgh, which is, if you look at where Scottish bands are from, Glasgow is like, there's 10 times as many bands from Glasgow, but Edinburgh's got Exploited and they've got Revillos. So they've got that going for them.
They've also got the Proclaimers.
I would walk 500 miles.
And you'd only have to walk 50 between those two cities.
How about the down by law version of that song? Well, it's killer.
Whatever. Haver. Whatever the fuck that means.
Not to digress too much, but the Proclaimers dudes, the twins, they were in a punk band in 1979 called Black Flag, B-L-A-K, Flag. Isn't that like, what are the, so coincidental?
They're epic people too. They do a lot for a lot of good causes.
That's cool.
And I love Waddy.
And I absolutely love the Proclaimers. Like, I Would Walk 500 Miles is a very, it doesn't really represent them.
Oh, no, not at all. You know? But,
I mean, it does to an extent, but it's, you know, what you've heard of that is nowhere near as good as, like, you know, some of the other stuff that they have put out that is just incredible. And for anyone listening to this, if you want to see something really cool, one of the Edinburgh football teams is called Hibernian, and the Proclaimers is one of Sunshine on Leith. The Proclaimers song is sung really amazingly by this fan base, and I, you know, challenge anyone listening to put Sunshine on Leith, Hibernian FC, and watch that video on YouTube and not cry. You'll get a little tear in your eye.
Wow.
Puck's not dead, oh no. Puck's not dead, oh no. All right, right on. This is 70s rules. Check it out on the playlist. Late.